A legendary newspaper editor who helped define modern American journalism has died. Benjamin Crowninshield Bradley led the Washington Post to national eminence through charm, drive, instinct, and most notably, an epic confrontation with the Nixon White House.
If you had told any editor of the Washington Post since the beginning of time, it was going to be a story that would 40 people would go to jail and the President of the United States would resign, he'd say, "Thank you, Lord."
That was Ben Bradley himself speaking on C-SPAN in 2010. He died this evening at the age of 93. NPR's David Folkenflik has this tribute.
Let's set the scene. Nearly 30 years ago, a young reporter is summoned from the newsroom to his boss's office, the big boss. In fact, the boss is Ben Bradley, with hair slicked back, an American aristocrat, wearing a tailored British shirt, his feet propped up on his desk. A powerful Democratic senator had complained that the young writer was looking into reports about his drinking. 30 years later, that young reporter, David Remnick, picks up the tale.
And I heard him say, "So what's going on with Moynihan?" And I, you know, quickly explained what I was doing and what I was up to. And then I unwisely ended my aria with, "And so, Mr. Bradley, don't worry." At which point I saw his silvery head rise above his shoe tips and say, "Worry? Me worry? I don't worry." And that was the end of the meeting.
A salty phrase, a hearty laugh, an unyielding journalistic backbone. Ben Bradley was well known for all three. Born to a family of Boston Brahmins, Bradley served in naval intelligence during World War II and saw major conflict in the Pacific arena. After the war, he launched a small paper in New Hampshire and decided to head south to seek a job at a bigger paper, landing a job in D.C. with the Post only because he refused to get off the train in Baltimore during a downpour. To tell the truth, Bradley only enjoyed mild success as a reporter. He next departed for Paris, where he became a diplomatic aide with ties to figures in the CIA. But in 1953, he joined Newsweek and thrived. He became close to a Georgetown neighbor, a young senator named John F. Kennedy, and would later find himself accused by Richard Nixon's defenders of being too cozy with the Democratic establishment. There was another, even more fateful connection, however. Bradley had convinced the publisher of the Washington Post, Phil Graham, to buy Newsweek, where he was Washington bureau chief. A few years later, the company's new president, Graham's widow, summoned Bradley.
So we went to a club I belonged to, and I said, "What is it that you do want to do? I notice you've turned these jobs down in New York."
This is the late Catherine Graham talking to Terry Gross on WHYY's Fresh Air.
And of course, Ben being Ben said, "Well, now that you ask me, I'd give my left one to be managing editor of the Post." And now that's a little bit vulgar, but Ben talks like that. And I was really brought up short because I didn't expect that.
Soon enough, Bradley joined the Post as managing editor, with the promise quickly fulfilled of leading the previously undistinguished paper as its executive editor. He went on a hiring spree, and a firing spree, too, embracing the so-called new journalism, giving feature writers leeway to develop a personalized voice once they had proven themselves. Len Downey was a young investigative reporter and editor at the Post in the 1960s and 1970s, and he says he wanted to prove himself to Bradley as desperately as anyone else.
He was sexy for women, and men wished they were him. He was attractive to men as well. People followed him around the newsroom with their eyes, followed him around physically when they were able to. They got excited when he came up to them in the newsroom. He had a magnetic effect on people.
When the Nixon administration convinced a judge to stop the Times from publishing new installments of the Pentagon Papers, Bradley and Graham decided to publish them right away. The decision exposed her company to significant financial risk. The ensuing Supreme Court ruling in the two papers' favor enshrined protections for the press against so-called prior restraint. That was not the only high-stakes clash between Bradley's newsroom and the Nixon administration. Two unknown Metro reporters for the Post started to unravel a criminal conspiracy involving the 1972 elections and a cover-up that led back to the White House itself. Bradley wasn't a details guy, but he helped to oversee the coverage of a story that soon took on the cinematic elements of a blockbuster thriller. Len Downey was one of the junior Metro editors helping to edit the stories, He recalls that rival news organizations had little appetite beyond the first stories of a break-in at Democratic Party headquarters.
Nobody else was following it. Nobody else seemed interested in it. Political reporters, including the political reporters in the Post newsroom, were skeptical of it. They couldn't believe that the president's campaign committee or the White House could be connected to something like this. And meanwhile, the Nixon administration was castigating the Post and our reporting every day. It left us in a very isolated position where we were concerned about the future of the paper, the future of our careers, if this story didn't pan out in the way we thought it would.
Bradley kept his cool and catapulted to celebrity along with his reporters, Carl Bernstein and Bob Woodward, thanks to the Watergate story, along with the book and movie, All the President's Men. Jason Robards won an Academy Award for playing an editor whose reporters helped expose the criminality of a White House.
You guys are about to write a story that says the former attorney general, the highest ranking law enforcement officer in this country, is a crook. Just be sure you're right.
For all that, Bradley could be a notably incurious editor. He didn't know the identity of Bob Woodward's top secret source until 2 years after President Nixon resigned. Bradley spoke to NPR's Michelle Norris in 2005 after the source was revealed to be a top FBI official, Mark Felt.
I knew that he was high-ranking, but I didn't know how high-ranking. And as a matter of fact, it wasn't very important what job he held, so long as he did one thing, and that was tell the truth. And before long, it was obvious that this man knew what he was talking about, because from day one, he never gave us a bad steer.
Bradley's strengths were often also closely linked to his weaknesses. The star system that orbited around him led to tensions within the newsroom. A celebration for a Pulitzer for one of those young stars, an expose by Janet Cook about an 8-year-old heroin addict, turned to ash in just hours. The story proved to be largely fabricated. She couldn't even introduce her editors to the boy. Bob Woodward had been the top editor for Metro News. The story was from his desk, and the scandal knocked him from the path to succeed Bradley, although he became a best-selling investigative author. But Bradley survived largely unscathed. So much of his DNA marked the paper as his own. David Remnick is now the editor of The New Yorker magazine.
Reporters need to know that they have to keep banging away at it, and they have to give their own energies and curiosity and aggressiveness full rein. And they have to have somebody saying behind them, it's okay, because the world is telling them all the time that it's not, whether it's politicians, PR agencies, and all the rest. They're saying it's not. And you need somebody behind you saying, keep at it. And that was Bradley's message in 1,000 different ways.
Remnick says it was almost touching. Several of the senior editors competing to replace Bradley adopted some of his sartorial traits, his reading glasses on a string, the slicked back hair, the striped shirts. After decades of Bradley's leadership, no one could imagine an editor with a different look. Len Downey succeeded Bradley in 1991, a less flamboyant, more careful newsroom leader with a dedication to investigative reporting. But the paper continued to carry Bradley's trademark swagger. After his retirement, Bradley served as a vice president-at-large for the paper's parent company, a charismatic emblem for the glory of the paper's journalism, even as it hit rocky economic times. Bradley wasn't introspective, but in an interview with his friend Jim Lehrer of PBS, he sought to pin down what animated him.
It changes your life, the pursuit of truth. And it, at least if you know that you have tried to find the truth and gone past the first apparent truth towards the real truth. It's very exciting, I find.
Among Bradley's survivors are his wife, the longtime Washington Post feature writer Sally Quinn, their son Quinn, and his son by an earlier marriage, the journalist Ben Bradley Jr. David Folkenflik, NPR News.